Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. Congress is back in Washington today after a two-week recess, and already the temperature in town is rising. Democrats are accusing the White House of a double standard when it comes to leaking classified information to the press. A White House shakeup could continue this week, and that immigration bill won't go away. Activists for illegal immigrants are calling for a Great American Boycott on May 1st. Well, joining us with more on the latest from Washington and what's expected in the week ahead is John Harwood, senior contributing writer for the Wall Street Journal, and also chief of Washington correspondent for CNBC. John, hello.
Hey, Robin.
And it doesn't seem as if it's going to remain quiet in Washington.
Not at all. You know, they had a crowded agenda when they left 2 weeks ago, especially with the collapse of that immigration bill. But you've got Iraq war funding that is coming back before the Congress, and you've got skyrocketing gas prices, which are suddenly crowding out other things on the agenda and really deepening the sense of anxiety among Republican members especially.
Well, let's look at some of the other items already on, as you said, this crowded agenda. The firing of CIA officer Mary McCarthy. She was fired after being charged with leaking classified information about secret CIA-run prisons to the press. Give us a little of the background on that and explain also why Democrats are so outraged over this.
Very jarring juxtaposition of events, because early in the week you had Dana Priest, the Washington Post reporter, who broke that story about secret prisons, won a Pulitzer Prize, and by the end of the week the Bush administration had fired Mary McCarthy, who may have been involved in the leaking of information for that story. Democrats, of course, want to use this as part of their argument that this is a secretive administration that is punishing truth tellers. They also believe they've got a hypocrisy argument because of the acknowledgement from the president in the wake of the Scooter Libby case that he had authorized the selective declassification of information to push back against the charges that Joe Wilson pressed about how the administration had used intelligence before the Iraq war.
The president acknowledging that he authorized the leaking of some previously classified information about weapons of mass destruction, and it's still unknown who actually leaked the identity of the CIA officer Valerie Plame. So with that in mind, some are saying that the White House needs to have a new message sent out, and there's somebody who's trying to help do that. Part of the shakeup of the White House, we saw Press Secretary Scott McClellan announce he was moving on last week. Any news on his replacement?
No concrete news, and White House officials have indicated that it might take a week or two, but most of the speculation is focused on Tony Snow, who worked as a speechwriter in the first Bush administration under the current president's father, subsequently went to work for Fox News. He now works for Fox News Radio, and Tony Snow appears to be the first choice and has to decide. He's had some health problems, which he may have overcome. But it's a very grueling job for anybody, much less a somebody who's got kids at home at 50 years old who's recovering from health problems. So I think he's got to decide if he wants to do it. If he does, it's likely that he'll get the job.
Well, the man behind this shakeup is the president's new chief of staff, Josh Bolten, who's also just issued a 5-point recovery plan to the staff, urging them, among other things, to brag more about White House accomplishments. Is he expected to be a much harder taskmaster than his predecessor, Andy Cardin, in the seconds we have? Do you think we're going to see other big changes this week?
I wouldn't expect other changes this week. People have said, indicated, White House officials have indicated that we're not going to see changes in the cabinet this week. I wouldn't describe Josh Bolten as a taskmaster. He is a genial person like Andy Card was, but he is more policy-oriented and somebody with a deep knowledge of budget, taxation, spending issues from his stint at OMB director and earlier work on trade. So he's going to try to make the substantive argument that the administration is succeeding on policy, which is something that simply hasn't broken through with the American people.
John Harwood, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal and with CNBC. John, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Well, once again, in a tape released on Al Jazeera this past weekend, Osama bin Laden is rallying Muslims to jihad. And today we want to take a look at a different call to action for Muslims here in America. Back in February, Los Angeles-based Syrian-born psychiatrist Wafa Sultan created an international firestorm when she went on the Arabic satellite station Al Jazeera as well, but to denounce Muslim attitudes towards violence. Dr. Sultan stunned her interviewer and another guest, a Muslim cleric, by boldly stating her views that what the world is witnessing now is not a clash of religions, but a clash of civilizations between the civilized West and backwards Islamic dictatorships. And she's not alone in voicing a dissenting opinion. A growing number of Muslims in the U.S. are speaking out, hearkening back to a concept called ijtihad, roughly translated as think for yourself, and in so doing, putting themselves at risk of death threats. Well, joining us today on the line are Asra Nomani, former Wall Street Journal reporter and author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She joins us on the phone from her hometown of Morgantown, West Virginia. Welcome, Asra.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Dr. Radwan Masmoudi. He studied robotics at MIT here in Massachusetts, but gave that up to found the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington, D.C. It focuses on modernizing and democratizing Islam. He joins us from the NPR studios in the Capitol. Welcome, Dr. Masmoudi.
Hi, Robin.
And Asra, I want to turn to you first because we understand your personal story plays into the work you're doing now. You were, as we said, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and you were working in Pakistan when your close friend Daniel Pearl was kidnapped and beheaded. That event seemed to have quite an impact on you. How did that affect you?
You know, for most of my life, I was living like much of the Muslim world as part of the silent moderate majority. When my friend Danny was kidnapped, we learned from the anti-terrorism specialists that the men who had plotted Danny's kidnapping had broken their strategy sessions to pray to Mecca. And I learned at that moment and realized that I had to wake up. And I really connected to the pain that was at the start of Wafa Sultan's anger against Islam, because I felt it too. But what I know is that we can't stay in that pain. We have to transform it into actual action. We have to transform it from anger into activism. I also believe in the progressive principles with which Islam was born 1,400 years ago. This is what I believe we've forgotten, and we are now in this terrible dark ages in our Muslim world because tradition, instead of progressive principles, are defining our communities. I know that that's not Islam.
Well, Dr. Masmoudi, you and other moderate Muslims have written about this concept of ijtihad, which some have translated as think for yourself or independent thinking. And scholars tell us that in the Muslim world, the doors of ijtihad were closed more than 500 years ago. It was sort of a reaction to the end of the Islamic Empire and a fear of other encroaching civilizations. But as you write, people in other countries can lose their jobs, be thrown in jail, even killed if they practice ijtihad. So how do you propose to do this?
Well, that's a very good question. I think what we need in the Muslim world right now, first and foremost, is the freedom to think and the freedom to discuss and debate all these issues. Islam, like all other religions, can be interpreted in different ways by different people. This is not unique to Islam. All religions have this ability to be understood differently by different people. The problem is when you have a small group of people kind of monopolizing Islam or the religious text and religious interpretation and excluding all other opinions, all other views from the public sphere. So that's why we at the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy feel that the first priority for us, for the Muslim world, in order to reinvigorate itself, in order to adapt Islamic teachings to the 21st century, is freedom and democracy in the Muslim world.
But to get a sense of how hard that's going to be, we want to talk about the broader efforts to bring democracy to the Islamic world. Asra Nomani, you went home after your friend Daniel Pearl was killed, and you decided to reform your mosque and had a huge battle to be allowed to pray with the men in the mosque. In about, I think, two-thirds of mosques, women are kept segregated from men, sometimes behind screens, behind walls. And you won that right, but now you are still the only woman who goes in to pray with the men. And from my understanding, you're not treated that well.
Yeah, you know, the point is that this challenge about bringing democracy into Muslim communities is not a story about over there. It's about over here also. In Morgantown, we have hardly known democracy in our mosque system. We only started having women elected into office after our transformation effort began, the death threats that I've gotten personally for these actions and for speaking out have not come from villages far away. They've come from Seattle, Washington, Santa Cruz, and Pennsylvania. The challenge is so immediate, and so people have to keep gathering the courage to stand up and take on all of these tactics of intimidation that are used to silence us. And we have to have, you know, courage in knowing that we are standing shoulder to shoulder with many other people.
Well, I want to interrupt for a second just to, you know, the standing shoulder to shoulder part brings another question up. While you both agree on the need for change, we, in reading many of the moderate Muslim voices, can see that not everyone agrees on what the change should be. For instance, I understand, Asra, you're calling for a gender jihad, liberating women. But Dr. Masmoudi, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree, but it depends what you mean by gender jihad. I think equal rights for men and women is of course an important principle that we have to all struggle for. I wouldn't necessarily put praying in the same line or having women as leaders of the Friday prayers, for example, as number one in my top priorities. Part of the difficulty of ijtihad is that it has to be credible. It has to be genuine. It has to come from Islamic theology and ideology in order for the masses to follow it. And if we push too hard, and especially if we start on the fringes or we start on the minor elements that provoke, kind of violent reaction or anger from people, I think we're doomed to fail.
Well, Asra, I just want to let Asra jump in. Asra, right. Your thoughts. Why is it so important to you to have what you call a gender jihad?
We have to have this kind of gender jihad for asserting women's rights as part of a larger peace jihad. I know in the mosque that Dr. Masmoudi was a part of in outside of the Washington, D.C. area, I've heard so many criticisms from people who say that women don't get on the board of directors. A mosque in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Dr. Masmoudi now lives, women have been fighting for 1 year just to be able to get into the main hall of the mosque. I mean, this is pathetic.
Well, let me please clarify my position. What Asra did, and I think in my opinion, went a little bit over the edge, is women as leading the prayers and men and women praying together in the same line. When you have men and women standing together in the same line and women being in the front of the men, that is, it creates a very difficult situation, and I don't think it is a priority. I would support fully women's participation and women's rights to speak, even to deliver, speeches in front of the mosques and to be on the board and to vote and to be elected. Of course, that is part of Islam.
And of course, Asra wants more than that, and therein lies one of the problems. Dr. Radwan Masmoudi, founder and president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, focused on modernizing and democratizing Islam, but Asra Nomani, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, calling for a gender jihad. She wants more for women. They both want reform, but don't agree on what kind, and they'll both be back in a moment. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Now we're continuing our talk with two moderate Muslims who disagree on how to go about reforming Islam. Asra Nomani is a former Wall Street Journal reporter and author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She's challenging Islam in her hometown of Morgantown, West Virginia, where she's won the right to pray in the main hall of her mosque alongside men. Dr. Radwan Masmoudi is founder and president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Washington. That's focused on modernizing Islam as well. But Dr. Masmoudi, you disagree with Asra's approach. You know, she's called for a gender jihad. But there's also been criticism of your push for democracy. For instance, Professor Mark Levine of the University of California points out that the word democracy has been sullied by American presidents who support what amount to benign dictators in the Middle East. Do you see that conflict?
Well, of course, pushing for democracy is not easy, and there are many entrenched sections and people and individuals in Muslim countries who are going to resist this push. I think we have to understand two things. First of all, the majority of Muslim population in over 10 countries, there was a poll that was conducted a couple of years ago, showed that over 90% of the people from Morocco to Indonesia, believed that democracy is the best form of government. So people are for democracy, but we do have dictators who, by the way, are not Islamic dictators. They are, you know, mostly secular dictators, and they are abusing the rights of the people, and they are stifling any dissent, any discussions, any debates, such as the one we are having right now. We cannot have these debates in most of the Arab countries, in most of the Muslim countries, and that's what we are pushing for. Now, when the U.S. government, for last 50 or 60 years, was actually supporting these dictators in the Arab world, it really made it very difficult to try to push for democracy. Now, in the last 2 or 3 years, the U.S. government is changing its policies and at least is talking about promoting democracy. But, you know, I don't think that we are there yet. I don't think that we have fully understood what it means to really support democracy. Many countries that we are supporting in the Arab and Muslim world are oppressive regimes. Secularism has ruled the Arab world for the last 50 years and has failed miserably. So if we want to push for democracy, we have to be ready for Islam to become actually more vibrant, actually more important in the lives of these societies. And that's what will allow Islam to become more tolerant.
Dr. Radwan Masmoudi speaking about bringing democracy to Islam, which sounds like a top-down approach, while Asra Nomani, your approach seems to be more bottom-up, you know, at the grassroots level. You've called for something called the Islamic Dream. What do you mean by that?
Well, right now, these laws that keep us in the dark ages, that punish women for sex outside of marriage or even for the act of being raped, these laws that keep women in the back of mosques, that don't allow them to stand at the front as prayer leaders because of the fear of sexuality, I mean, all of these laws are defined basically centuries ago in the 8th and 9th centuries, and we're stuck. We've been sitting in quicksand. And so what we need to do is allow for a new Sharia that I think Dr. Masmoudi has spoken about, probably not to go as far as I would wish, but we need a new school of jurisprudence that goes beyond these current schools of jurisprudence that define most of our Muslim world. I mean, all this talk for this by the Center of the Study of Islam and Democracy, they don't help the average citizen in our sitting in our communities. I get emails from so many young Muslims who are basically in depression and terrible anxiety because every single day they're facing off against all of these traditional interpretations of Islam that are suffocating them.
Well, you know, having just listened to you both, I have a question for you both. Do you think that now that these voices calling for reform in the Muslim world can work together?
I think they can work together because we actually can have these kind of conversations and recognize that we've got common ground. We are all very frustrated with the way this ideological terrorism in our Muslim world has hijacked Islam.
I think absolutely we have to work together. We have to respect each other, and we have to listen to each other and work together. My only requirement, or my only the only thing that I think we need in order to be able to work together and to succeed in our mission, which is so important and so critical, is that we have to start from the point that we respect Islam, that we love Islam, and we're not out to destroy Islam or to attack it. This is the problem I'm having with some of what Wafa Sultan, for example, said. I mean, she was clearly insulting not only all Muslims, but insulting Islam itself. If you are insulting Islam and insulting all Muslims, guess what? You're not going to be able to reform anything because nobody's going to listen to you.
Dr. Wafa Sultan is, of course, the Los Angeles-based psychiatrist who not only criticized Islamic dictators, but criticized Islam itself. I want to ask one last question to you, Asra Nomani. Do you have hope that you'll see notable change in Islam in your lifetime?
Well, I know that we can see change in the next generation. The status of women's rights in America, it was transformed in one generation from the 60s until today. Same as the situation for blacks in the South. Now, are we going to have the majority? I don't think so. Are we going to have at least new mosques where women can stand in the front, where they can stand at the pulpit? I think we will. And that's how I believe Reformation happens in all religions. And by the time my son, who's now three, becomes an adult, we will take the slam out of Islam, and we will be able to actually put out into the world the beautiful expression of our faith that was supposed to be born centuries ago.
Take the slam out of Islam. Asra Nomani, a former Wall Street Journal reporter and author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. We also spoke to Dr. Radwan Masmoudi, founder and president of the Washington-based Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. I want to thank you both.
Thank you very much.
And this quick note about tomorrow on Here and Now, what does a venti soy latte with two shots say about us? A Temple University professor is researching Starbucks, and you'll be amazed at the things he's found out. Well, for one thing, venti doesn't mean anything. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes.
And now, at the ongoing Enron trial, the spotlight is now on the founder of the failed Texas energy company. Ken Lay is on the witness stand for the first time today, defending himself against criminal charges stemming from the collapse of the company he built. Lay's appearance follows more than a week of sometimes testy testimony by the company's former CEO, Jeffrey Skilling. The government claims the men lied repeatedly to investors and employees about Enron's financial health. Skilling and Lay say that it was bad publicity from news stories raising questions about Enron's financial health that actually sparked the crisis and eventually forced the company into bankruptcy in December of 2001. John Emschweiler is covering the Enron trial for the Wall Street Journal. I spoke to him earlier today before he took his seat in the courtroom, and I asked him first about that defense contention about bad publicity. Now, Skilling and Lay say stories in John's paper in the Wall Street Journal presented unfair speculation about financial conditions at Enron.
I wrote some of those stories, so I'm fairly familiar with them. We raised questions about some of these off-book partnerships called the LJM partnerships and run by Andy Fastow, the chief financial officer. We thought then, and we still think now, that they were legitimate areas of inquiry. The stories, you know, they were part of what happened at the time. Whether they caused the collapse or something, I don't think they did, but you know, other people will have to make their own judgment.
Well, the Enron leaders aren't saying that the stories weren't true.
I think their implication is that we were drawing unfairly negative inferences or questions about the partnerships, which they at the time said were perfectly proper, and the dealings that Enron had with them were perfectly proper. Since then, it's gotten a little more complicated for them, since they're now saying Andy Fastow, who at the time they were strongly defending, they now are calling Andy a crook, and that he used the partnerships to steal money from Enron, millions and millions of dollars. So it's a little harder for them to fully defend the partnerships, since they now say Andy used them for bad ends.
Well, is there a precedence for this, for a business claiming that business writers in writing about the business might have, you know, sent the business into a spiral?
Most business executives, when they get what they view as negative press or critical stories, will blame the reporters, blame the newspaper or the other publication for, you know, pushing down their stock price. Not many companies, of course, collapse with quite the spectacular nature that Enron did.
Well, what else, John, do you think Ken Lay's defense is going to be?
Ken Lay is a, you know, I think he's going to get on the stand and hope to win over the jury a bit. He's a very likable man. So I think, one, if you can get the jury to feel positive, you know, feelings about him, that's always a help for defense. And also, he's also trying to, I think, point out that he did his best. In other words, his picture is, you know, I came back to the CEO job in August of 2001 when Mr. Skilling left the company, had to get myself reacquainted with the day-to-day stuff, which I sort of turned over to Jeff. And while we had some problems, which I tried to deal with, the company we think was fundamentally sound. It just got caught in this sort of market panic post 9/11, and while we may have made mistakes, there was nothing illegal done. If he can come off as a nice enough, believable enough guy, it's a defense that could work with the jury.
And how much is personality a part of this?
Jurors are like the rest of us. You know, you have you have positive feelings about a person, you when you look at pieces of information, that comes into play when you're trying to evaluate things. And a lot of things in a trial, certainly this one where there's so many complicated financial transactions, comes down to credibility. Do I believe the guy who says there was a bad thing going on here, or do I believe the guy who says, no, it was not a bad thing, it was it's a good thing going on? And if you like one better than the other, it could well influence how you finally come down on that question.
Could you also explain for us, as we said, Jeffrey Skilling testified last week, Kenley takes the stand today. The two men have different charges, 28, I believe, against Skilling, 6 against Kenley. How are the charges different, and how closely are their two cases tied?
Skilling was viewed by the government as sort of the ringleader, mastermind of this alleged conspiracy that dates back to 1999. So the view was he was the guy who was really kind of running the company on a day-to-day basis. Kenley was much more viewed as sort of the public face of Enron, the man who dealt with presidents and prime ministers. And the charges against him are largely related to the time period after Mr. Skilling left in August 2001 up through the bankruptcy in December of that year. So it's a much narrower time period. So they're tied, but, they're also somewhat disconnected in the sense that Mr. Lay's period of alleged wrongdoing largely is after Mr. Skilling left.
How will Kenley be able to offset testimony against him that, for instance, he knew or seemed to acknowledge and condone back in 2000 that the company manipulated its earnings and raised analyst expectations? This was the testimony of, an Enron official who testified against him already. How is he going to offset that?
Well, I presume he's going to either, one, deny that he had the conversation, or at least if the conversation took place, that he didn't see anything incriminating. The government says these were acts of manipulation aimed at misleading the public. The defense says, no, it's just a big, complex company, and, these kind of changing numbers and things are all part of the normal business routine, and the government just doesn't want to acknowledge that.
Kenley was the public face of Enron. As you read, he helped get the baseball stadium in Houston built. He hobnobbed with President and also when he was Governor Bush. How is Houston reacting to his taking the stand?
I think, he certainly still has supporters in town. He made a lot of friends when he was here. You can also sense that there's been bitterness, certainly among the former employees of Enron, about what happened to the company, and some of those people blame the leadership, Mr. Lay, Mr. Skilling, and others.
John Emshwiler is covering the Enron trial for the Wall Street Journal. In fact, he's trying to get into the courtroom now. He's speaking to us from Houston, where Enron founder Kenley is on the witness stand for the first time today. And just a quick question, John. Jeffrey Skilling testified for 8 days. What's the sense of how long Kenley will be on the stand?
They're guessing about 4.
Mm-hmm. And after that, closing arguments, the trial's been going on for about a month and a half. When do you think it'll wrap up?
We're guessing by about second week of May it'll go to the jury.
Yeah, and after the government rested its case, some said that the defense really needed to hit a home run. Did Skilling do that last week?
Well, he had some points that he scored on, but he also had some damage done to him, I think, by the cross. So it's hard to tell. When you sit in the gallery, especially if you've been covering the thing for years, you have certain reactions to some information, but have no idea if the jury's having the same reaction. So they're pretty impassive, so it's hard to read them.
So do you really have no idea at this point how this case is going to come out?
I've never tried to predict trials because you just literally don't know what's going on in jurors' minds. I try not to predict because I'm usually wrong.
John Emshwiler with The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure. Take care.
Well, still to come today, have you been to the movies lately? How did you feel about seeing the trailer to that 9/11 film, United 93? Well, some theaters have pulled that trailer because of audience reaction. We'll speak to director Paul Greengrass. You're listening to Here and Now. On a campus filled with stars, Harvard University sophomore Kaiva Viswanathan was a supernova. As a freshman, she signed a two-book deal for a reported $500,000 and garnered a movie deal with DreamWorks as well. Her debut novel, How Opal Mehta Got Kissed, Got Wild, and Got a Life, came out this month and is listed as number 32 on the New York Times bestseller list. But now there are charges that Viswanathan's book is strikingly similar to two other coming-of-age novels by author Megan McCafferty. Here's a passage from McCafferty's 2001 book, Sloppy Firsts.
Sabrina was the brainy angel, yet another example of how every girl had to be one or the other. Pretty or smart? Guess which one I got. You'll see where it's gotten me.
This next passage from Viswanathan's Opal Mehta.
Moneypenny was the brainy female character, yet another example of how every girl had to be one or the other, smart or pretty. I had long resigned myself to be Category 1, and as long as it got me to Harvard, I was happy. Except it hadn't gotten me to Harvard.
Well, joining us with more on the story is reporter Lisa Wagsness of the Boston Globe. And Lisa, we know the Harvard Crimson first reported on this yesterday, and they came up with many other similarities.
That's right, Robin. They had, I think it was 8 different passages where there were similar phrases and similar descriptions, similar words used between the two books.
Well, I know you have today's Boston Globe in front of you. It repeats some of those phrases. Can you just give us a sample?
Sure, I can. This is from Sloppy Firsts. Bridget is my age and lives across the street. For the first 12 years of my life, these qualifications were all I needed in a best friend, but that was before Bridget's braces came off and her boyfriend, Bert, got on, and before Hope and I met in our 7th grade honors class.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Opal Mehta, which says, Priscilla was my age and lived 2 blocks away. For the first 15 years of my life, these were the only qualifications I needed in a best friend. We had first bonded over our mutual fascination with the abacus in a playgroup for gifted kids, but that was before freshman year when Priscilla's glasses came off and the first in a long string of boyfriends got on.
So there, you know, there's exact wording. Qualifications were all I needed in a best friend, and braces in Sloppy First seemed to be exchanged for glasses
right.
in Opal Mehta. What are the different people involved in this story saying, the publishers, the authors?
Well, not much right now, actually. Random House, which publishes Megan McCafferty's books, basically said yesterday that they had sent a letter outlining some of their concerns to Viswanathan's publisher, which is Little Brown & Company, late last week, just raising the concerns. And Little Brown & Company hasn't yet had anything to say about this.
Yeah, and tell us more about Viswanathan. I know the Globe here in Boston did a huge feature on, you know, this very promising young author who had this huge advance for a book. What do we know about her?
Right. Well, she was born in India, and she lived the first decade of her life or so in England. She moved when she was about 12 years old with her family to New Jersey, which is where she kind of did the rest of her growing up. And she was also a very good student, also a budding literary talent, even as a high school student. And it was actually her college counselor who sort of spotted her. And the counselor was a published author herself. So she sort of helped Viswanathan get an agent, and that sort of sped along the process to her getting a book deal.
And once she got the book deal, the editors really have said that they really helped her shape the book. I mean, everybody was behind this young writer. She told the Globe that in the last 2 weeks of school, she was studying for finals and trying to get the last 50 pages done and was writing in a rush.
That's right.
What is the sense of, you know, what's happened here?
Well, it's really hard to tell. That's a very good question, and I think that's possibly going to be coming out over the next several days. I mean, we haven't even heard Viswanathan's side of the story yet. She did tell the reporter who did a story for the Globe in February about her that, you know, she was writing this during her freshman year at Harvard, knocking off 50 pages every couple of weeks, and even as she was studying for finals, just getting the book done. So, you know, she is a first-time writer. She's very young. And so I'm sure that there will be a lot more discussion about how that factors into this whole story as it unfolds.
Lisa Wagsness is a reporter with the Boston Globe, speaking to us about allegations of plagiarism in the debut novel of a Harvard sophomore. Lisa, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We'll be right back. United 93, the first major Hollywood feature film about 9/11, opens in theaters this Friday. It looks at the events of that morning through the eyes of air traffic controllers, the FAA, the military, and finally those aboard United 93 who attempted to take over the plane before it crashed in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The film has been expectedly controversial. The trailer was pulled from some theaters because patrons were finding even that brief reminder of 9/11 too upsetting. So why make the movie? Well, Here and Now's Renee Graham spoke with United 93's director and writer, Paul Greengrass, to find out.
I think all of us, although we don't agree with where we go from here, obviously, in your country or mine or in Europe, I think we all agree that it goes back to those 2 hours on the morning of September the 11th. And although it's often said never forget, I wonder how closely we really do look at those 2 hours. Why do I think that? Well, I'll give you, for instance, I think if you were to do a poll, I think you would find staggering numbers of Americans today believe that United 93 was shot down by the military, and that was has subsequently been covered up. I mean, you've only got to look at the internet to see the strength and the depth of that conspiracy theory. And obviously it's not true. I mean, the reality is that the military didn't even know about United 93 until 4 minutes after it had crashed, and there wasn't a fighter jet within 100 miles. But the fact that that conspiracy theory is so deep and broadly felt in this country and abroad indicates to me that we really need to look at the facts of the matter. I mean, and if you look at the events of 9/11... what you see, of course, is that we went to war in the space of 2 hours against an enemy we never saw, we didn't understand at all, and in a state of great confusion. And that should give us pause, I think, moving forward from here.
With your excellent film, Bloody Sunday, which was about the 1972 killings of demonstrators by British troops in Northern Ireland, that was made 30 years after the incident took place. Mm-hmm. 9/11 was less than 5 years ago. How do you respond to people who say it's just too soon for this film?
You know, I understand that to a certain extent, but this is a mature democracy here. And the issues of 9/11 and what we do today in the light of 9/11 are important to each and every one of us. And so whilst there will be some people who won't want to go and see this film, and I understand that, you know, it's painful and difficult, I think there will be a large number of people who take the view that it will be instructive and helpful to go back. And let's face it, there's been a debate in your country going on non-stop. A passionate discussion has been going on about what 9/11 means, what we can or should or shouldn't do in the light of 9/11. And surely now it's time that filmmakers should be allowed to join that conversation.
Let's listen to a scene from the film where the passengers aboard Flight 93 decide to take action and take over the plane.
They are not going to take us back to the airport.
Is any other option we have?
We're going to die. We're going to die. They're flying this into a building. We're going to die.
You should not interfere.
There's a lot of us, but we got to do something. You see how low we are?
Is there a weapon? Is there something we can use?
Go back. You go back. Stewardess, listen to me. Are you listening?
I'm listening.
Go back and you get every weapon you can.
Unlike, say, the sinking of the Titanic or the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were no survivors from Flight 93 to provide eyewitness accounts. At what point does your film go from fact, such as phone calls between passengers and loved ones, to conjecture?
Of course, we can't know every single detail of what happened aboard United 93. But we can know a tremendous amount of what happened, obviously, from the large number of phone calls, also from the cockpit voice recorder, 30 minutes of that.
So you had access to the cockpit recorder?
Access to people who'd listened to it, yeah. Now, there's the 9/11 Commission report, of course, which gives a very concise and detailed examination of what happened aboard United 93. Then moving on from there, you've got the way this film was made. We made this film collectively. Firstly with the families, all 40 families who approved this film and worked with us. But then more broadly, a lot of the people in this film were there on the day in the air traffic control rooms, in the National Command Center, people like Ben Sline, who was in charge of the civilian aviation system.
Who plays himself.
Who plays himself.
and I don't want to board full of these planes hitting every building on the East Coast. This is a national emergency. Everyone lands regardless of destination.
That's going to cost billions.
Just do it.
We have hundreds of international flights coming in. They're already in the air.
No, I don't want any more international flights crossing the borders. They don't have to go back where they came from. Nobody's coming into the country from now on.
Everyone,
shut off the East Coast. Shut off all the international from Europe. Shut off South America. Shut off the West Coast. Nothing over the top either.
Canada too.
Shut down the airspace.
The mythology of United 93 that I think most people have is the idea that the passengers at the back of the plane got a dining cart and charged down the center aisle of the plane towards the hijackers. Mm-hmm. Now, we will never know what happened. But I'm absolutely certain, and so is everybody else involved in this film, that that could never have happened. Now, why? Because we had real stewardesses and we were in a real plane with real dining carts. You cannot run a dining cart down the center aisle of an aeroplane.
Right, so they essentially said that could not have happened.
It could not have happened. What you would do if you were tackling a man who you thought would have a bomb is you'd run as fast as you can, because that would take a matter of seconds. Now, do you call that conjecture? I don't. I call that a rational, reasoned attempt to gain the truth in order to replace mythology with something realistic.
Well, I just want to get back quickly to something mm-hmm. you said, where you mentioned in working with the families throughout the production mm-hmm. and getting the approvals of the families.
Yeah.
Would you have done this film if there were family members who were vigorously opposed to the project?
No, I wouldn't have done it, no.
Why not?
Because they have wisdom that we often miss if we don't listen carefully enough to them. Secondly, I think my work speaks for itself in its unswerving commitment to opposing the use of political violence. But thirdly, this... I think always, if you make films in this subject, you must gently and insistently ask the question, why?
But do you feel to answer that question properly, you have to have the cooperation
correct.
Of the families?
You cannot make these films. It wouldn't be appropriate. And I have always made, whether it's Bloody Sunday or Omar about the final bombing in Northern Ireland or this film, United 93, worked with all of the families because it gives you an inner strength, and it's the foundation stone of the credibility and the legitimacy of the project.
Given the way that 9/11 has been politicized, mm-hmm. are you concerned that some people may perceive this film as a statement as to why America is at war, especially coming at a time when public support for the war in Iraq is in steady decline?
Well, it's not a political statement, this film. Of course, you're right. We're very bitterly divided at the moment in your country and in mine and in Europe and elsewhere. But it seems to me that what this film says is, let's all of us, on whatever side of that divide we are, let's go back to those 2 hours and try and move through them together, collectively in the agreed knowledge that whatever it is we think has happened in the last 5 years and may happen here about which we disagree, we can at least agree, all of us, that it began there. So let's try and pick up the threads and see if there's any lessons that we can learn.
United 93 filmmaker Paul Greengrass speaking with Here and Now's Renee Graham. Well, one of those who died on United 93 was 20-year-old Diora Bodley. 2 days after her death, her father, Daryl Bodley, wrote a song in her memory. It's called Steps to Peace. Here's a sample. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join